This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Donald Trump's success in this presidential campaign has been attributed to many things. His celebrity, the fact that he speaks his mind, the fact that what he says and the attitude he projects connects with a lot of voters who feel like strangers in their own country. But our guest today has yet another theory. She says much of the Donald's success can be attributed to his brand. He isn't selling policy ideas, you may have noticed. He's selling a glamorous lifestyle, the Trump brand, which represents the American dream of wealth and status that many of us yearn for, but which few will achieve. Those are the thoughts of Virginia Postrell, the author of The Power of Glamour and a columnist for Bloomberg View. She's in town on behalf of the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to them, she joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte.
Great to be with you.
Nice to see you. You are here to talk, obviously, about glamour and how elements of our attraction to things glamorous may be impacting this presidential election. But first, let's talk about what attracted you to the subject of glamour in the first place and the fact that you wrote this book, The Power of Glamour.
Right.
When did you become interested in it and why?
Well, it's very interesting because if you had told me, say, 10 years ago that I would write a book about glamour, I would have said, you must be kidding, because I'm interested in the unglamorous, gritty side of things. I'm interested in, you know, logistics and, you know, supply chain management, which actually will be relevant. You know, how does business get done? But I had written a book called The Substance of Style, which was not about glamour. It was about bringing better look and feel to ordinary things, business hotels, toilet brushes, and why that was valuable and why that was a source of economic value that wasn't just manipulation. I got invited to write an essay on glamour, and I thought, well, that's interesting, and I took up the challenge, and I really didn't know very much about glamour. And I became very interested in the idea of glamour as a phenomenon that takes many different forms. It's not just fashion. It's not just old movies, and we can analyze how it works. How does seeing a certain image create this sense of projection and longing? If only life could be like that. If only I could drive that car. If only I could live in that house. If only I could, you know, be that person or be with that person.
And what you just said to me, that drives everybody almost every day. I mean, the reason we buy that new car, whatever that car is, or that computer, or that appliance, or that big screen television, or even that piece of jewelry, we do it because we think we're going to be happy as a result of having done it, and we're going to be better off for having done it, and our life will be better for having done it.
So it's not always because of glamour. I mean, you might think you might buy something just to solve a problem.
Yeah.
You know, you're a cook and you hear about this new appliance that, you know, does sous vide cooking, and wow, that sounds cool, and you'll do that, and that'll be fun. That's one thing. But glamour is definitely placed at that. I mean, you see the pair of shoes in the store, and whether it's, you know, women's high heels or whether it's great, you know, some Nike's latest sneakers, and you think, you know, you picture yourself there and you picture, wow, you know, what kind of great person you sort of. The glamour has this idea of the life we wish we had. You know, it invites you to imagine your deepest longings realized. And that could be looking at a kitchen design and thinking, wow, if I had that kitchen, I would have kind of imagine I would entertain and I would have my family. And it's really, you know, it's not about stuff. It's really about these emotional connections.
Although this definition of glamour that we're talking about right now is relatively new in the scheme of things. Like you said, the best place to find the original definition is to find an old dictionary.
Yeah.
Because it was different. And I know that I used to watch HBO's True Blood.
Oh, True Blood. Yes,
yeah.
They used a play.
Well, the vampires would glamour you so that you would not remember your experience, or you would do their bidding. They would look into your eyes.
Right.
That's what that's about, right?
Well, that is a play on the original use of glamour. The original idea of glamour, the original definition of the word was a Scottish word. Was a literal magic spell, but it didn't do what they did on True Blood. What a glamour did was make you see things that weren't really there. and make things, and usually with the connotation of making things look better than they really were. Well, you can see how that literal sense is still, now that we're metaphorical, that sense of illusion and magic is still embedded in the idea of glamour. So when you think of something glamorous, it hides things. It's not evil. It's not intrinsically evil, but it hides flaws.
It paints a pretty picture.
It's
Photoshop for life.
Exactly. And and so if you think about glamorous vacation, you know, you want to go on vacation and you're looking at, you know, websites or brochures and you see these glamorous pictures and they're not false exactly, but they hide things. They don't tell you about the jet lag. They don't remind you about packing your bags. They don't remind you about sand in your bathing suit or, you know, whatever.
Or that it might rain your entire vacation.
Or that it might rain. You know, it doesn't. So glamour is this it's an illusion. It's not completely false. It has to have some element of the truth, and it tells us the truth about our desires.
And it communicates – it's a method of communication.
It's a method of communication. And the idea that I use in The Power of Glamour, and this was sort of my aha moment, was, oh, glamour is a method of communication the way humor is a method of communication. How do you know if something's funny? It's not because I can tell you the rules for making something funny. It's because the audience responds with a certain emotion. And glamour is the same way. The audience responds with this sense of projection and longing. And so that means that different people find different things glamorous.
So it's emotional, but it's also aspirational.
That's
it seemed
right.
To me,
it always – so one thing I do in the book is I look at, okay, we can't reduce it to a style, but we can find elements that are in all forms of glamour, whether you're talking, you know, about a glamorous travel vacation or a glamorous career – glamorous career of a radio host.
Yeah.
Right. It's never glamorous when you know all the details. But and one, the first element is this promise of escape and transformation, a different, better life in different, better circumstances.
Interesting you bring up the glamorous life of a radio person, but both, a lot of people think that television is glamorous.
Oh, yeah.
Because people are pretty on television and the sets are beautiful and the lighting is terrific if you're on a high-dollar show. But when you walk off the set, the set's made of cardboard, first of all, and when you walk off the set, you're in a crappy building.
Right. So, yeah.
And, most parts.
And this goes to the second element of glamour, which is grace, or this illusion of effortlessness, hiding the flaws, hiding the costs, hiding the support structures, anything that might break the spell. And in the book, I talk about two different types of grace. One you've sort of alluded to, which is what I call darkroom grace. That's when you actually have an image and you manipulate the image, whether it's just by cropping or whether it's by retouching. The other is what I call theatrical grace, where it is graceful in the moment. You know, you really are very good at doing this radio thing, but there's all this support behind the scenes that you don't see. And I talk about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers dancing gracefully in the movies, and within the frame of the story, they've just met and suddenly are doing this perfectly choreographed routine. But in reality, there was a lot of rehearsal and, you know, sweat and sore muscles and bruised feet and doing things wrong.
But that's the whole Hollywood thing is, I think, where a lot of us get our idea of what glamour is. And you have a wonderful TED Talk that our listeners can go and see online, where you're talking about glamour, and you use, in part of that talk, photos from the 1940s of people like Hedy Lamarr, famous Hollywood movie stars, and you show these photographs, and we have come to call those photographs glamour shots.
Yes.
Because they're not looking at you, they're not looking at the camera, they're kind of tilted, the lighting is perfect, it lights just the perfect part of their face, and they're off looking into the middle distance somewhere. Why did we see that then, and why do we still see it now as glamorous? What makes that glamorous?
Well, this goes to the third element, which is, so you've got this this aspiration is the word you used. I talk about escape and transformation. That's, you know, wouldn't it be great to be a movie star? Then you've got the grace, those pictures. Many of them were taken by George Harrell. He when people would ask him how to make glamorous photos, he said, well, it's, you know, easy, bring out the best, conceal the worst, and leave something to the imagination. And then that's the third element, which is mystery. Mm-hmm. You always have to leave something to the imagination so that the audience can project into whatever is glamorous their desires, their, you know, what it would be like for them to be like that, to be in that place, to be that person. Glamour isn't opaque. It's not completely mysterious. We have to be invited in.
Also not transparent.
But it's also not transparent. It's translucent. It allows just enough to invite us in.
Because you say that, I think in the TED Talk, you say that stained glass windows are glamorous because you can't really see through them, but the light comes in.
Yeah,
essentially.
Yeah, that's they can be. They create that sense of mystery and sort of elevation. Yeah.
So we're going to get to the subject of glamour and Donald Trump, the intersection of glamour with Donald Trump, and in the minds of the electorate. And you said a second ago something interesting, and that was the fact that the definition of glamour is going to change from person to person according to your life experience. So for somebody who works a 9-to-5 job in a drab, dull office and who comes home and has to cook dinner for the kids and take them to the softball practice and pay the mortgage and find a way to have two cars because the husband has to have a car, the wife has to have a car, and maybe the kid has to have a car. Their idea of what glamour is going to be very different from what Donald Trump's idea of what glamour
is. Yes, that's it.
So what do you think is glamorous, if anything, to Donald Trump?
Well,
White House?
That's a really interesting way of posing the question. I think he has a glamorous idea of what it would be like to be president. And he's projecting that in his campaign. He's inviting his voters to share his glamorous idea of what it's like to be president. And I talked about this a little bit in my John Locke Foundation talk last night. There's a guy at the Cato Institute named Gene Healy who wrote a book called The Cult of the President. He actually wrote it during the Bush administration. He's since revised it during the Obama administration. But it's this idea that we, the American people, whoever we vote for, have this tendency to make the president into this sort of magical figure and then over time to invest the president with more and more power to the detriment of the congressional supposed balance of power and to the detriment of our liberties. But going to the glamour side of it, when we talk about the presidency and we talk about, you know, the leader of the free world and the commander in chief, and I mean he is these things or she is these things, but it's this image of a person who has more sort of magical powers, and that goes into this, and it's very distant from all of our lives. I mean, even people who are members of Congress, who don't know what it's like to be president. I mean, you know, Barack Obama comes in the first day and, wow, he's in for even though he's been in the Senate and been in public life, he learns things that, you know, can turn your hair gray.
Yeah, and have. Every single president. The president is the only person that we elect universally. All the Congress people, the senators, we don't all elect them, so we don't know them. He's the only person we really know top to bottom. And all these powers that we invest in him, I want to talk about that when we come back from the break, because a lot of that came about in the 20th century.
Yes.
When the media came into the picture. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Raptor Center, featuring their summer flight show and new Sunday Raptor Encounters. For details and flight times, carolinaraptorcenter.org. It is commencement season. I got caught in Queen's University traffic last Saturday, and graduates are throwing their caps in the air as they prepare to approach the real world, but many will do so with record amounts of debt, more than $37,000 per student on average. That's higher than last year's graduates, and next year promises to be higher still. So what's behind this increase, and what, if anything, can be done to help ease it? What can parents do? We talk to experts about that tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, coal mining companies in Appalachia have been steadily laying off workers and closing down. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders promised to bring new economic opportunities to the area. Donald Trump says he can revive the industry. Competing visions for America's coal workers and the future of the region.
The Diane Rehm Show, this morning from 10 to noon, after Charlotte Talks, on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Virginia Pastrell is our guest, the author of The Power of Glamour, a columnist for Bloomberg View, in town to speak last night to the John Locke Foundation. And we're gonna end up talking here about the intersection of glamour and Donald Trump and his appeal to a lot of people that may be what it is. They don't realize that's what it is, but that is what it is in her opinion. And you talked a second ago about how we invest all these magical powers that come, and we give them great titles, the commander-in-chief, the leader of the free world, all of which are true. But until the 20th century, nobody ever saw the president. Nobody ever heard the president speak until radio came along. I mean, Calvin Coolidge was the first person on the radio. But now the television is the president is not only on television from the Oval Office making speeches like John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson. They're on The Tonight Show. They're on Jimmy Fallon. They're on Jimmy Kimmel's show. They're everywhere because that's how they reach through to the people. And not only are they glamorous because they're the commander-in-chief, but they're kind of a TV star.
Yeah. Yeah, and now with Trump, he is a TV star.
And he is a TV star.
For president. And I remember when Bill Clinton went on the Arsenio Hall show.
It was a big deal.
And that was a big deal because it was a very different type of show. And that, in a way, undercuts the glamour of the presidency. And I'll talk about this.
What, too much
access? Because it undercuts the mystery. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, in politics, usually we don't exactly want glamour in the president. We want charisma. We want somebody who, you know, makes us feel like we know them and we want to follow them. And that's more that's there's less mystery in charisma. Barack Obama in 2008 was unusual because he actually was a glamorous candidate. He was this guy who'd come out of, you know, he was in the Senate, but he was largely unknown, and he had this interesting background that was sort of unusual, exotic, biracial, Hawaii, you know, the international background. And people really – his supporters really projected onto him everything they wanted in a president, everything they wanted in a country. People back then – it's hard to remember this, but there were people who would say, well, yes, he says such and such, but actually – he's lying to those other people. He agrees with me, you know, which is an extraordinary thing to say about a politician, that he's lying and that's a good thing, you know. But people really projected onto him all this stuff because he was a glamorous figure, not merely a charismatic figure. And I think especially in his first term, that made things somewhat difficult for him because different people who had voted for him – I'm not talking about people who didn't like him – people who had voted for him expected different things from him. And so glamour is a useful thing to have when you're campaigning, not as useful when you're governing.
Well, let's talk about that, because the difference between glamour and charisma, because others have said, and you're among them, that Barack Obama, when he was a candidate, had a lot of glamour about him. But you say that he had a charisma deficit. How would you characterize his presidency as a result?
Right. So part of Obama's appeal was that he was this cool, contained character. And that really enhanced his glamour because he seemed graceful under pressure and kept that distance. But again, particularly in his first term, you would hear people who liked him. I mean, we're talking about people who like him. We're not talking about people who were frustrated because he wasn't – you know, he didn't feel their pain. He wasn't empathizing enough. He wasn't being the popular
– Too cool.
It was too cool. He wasn't having the popular touch as much. And you contrast him to somebody like Bill Clinton, who has, you know, charisma out the wazoo.
And who actually said, I feel your pain.
And he said, I feel your pain. And this – what we're more accustomed to and what we generally like better in a political or a public figure in general, it doesn't have to be a politician, is this quality of leadership, this personal quality of charisma, which is a personal quality, the way intelligence is a quality. I mean, some people have it and some people don't. And I'm not saying Barack Obama has none, because he never would have gotten where he is if he didn't have more than the average Joe. But he that's not his big strength.
Right.
And the thing about charisma is people want to follow you. People – you decide where you're going, and they follow you. You know, they want to enlist in your cause. Whereas when it's glamour, it's more about them projecting what they want onto you, and they can be disappointed.
So let's talk about the current crop of candidates, and we'll leave Bernie Sanders in it because he's still in it.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton, let's start with her. Hillary Clinton, glamorous or charismatic? Or neither?
I think she's neither, actually, which is really unusual. I mean, I'm not saying she's not to anybody glamorous and not to anybody charismatic, but compared to the typical person who rises to her level, rises to her level as a presidential candidate, I think there are plenty of secretaries of state or senators who've had what she has, which is essentially she's very hardworking, she's intelligent, she's very disciplined. And that's what she brings to the table. And I think she helped her husband a lot in his political career by bringing those qualities. But she is not blessed with either charisma or with glamour.
Can she win without either?
Yes, it's harder, but it's possible.
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders is interesting because he's not at all what I would think of as a glamorous figure. I mean, he's got crazy hair, and he, you know, is like he's like your crazy old uncle at the, you know. But if you look at his ads, and I've done some on YouTube, he does. I mean, the only thing I can compare them to is like Reagan's Morning in America ads. He has these very evocative, emotional Americans coming together kind of ads that create a kind of glamorous picture of the country. And we can talk about this with Trump. You know, a candidate does not need to be glamorous as a person in order to use glamour in a campaign. Because you much more often in politics we see policies that are glamorous, or ideas that are glamorous, or visions of the country that are glamorous, even if the politician is very well known and not particularly mysterious.
So John F. Kennedy talking about the new frontier and handing the torch to a new generation and putting a man on the moon in 10 years makes us feel good about ourselves.
Exactly.
We live in a great place, a fantastic place.
Right. And it's interesting.
It's morning in America.
It's morning in America, that sort of thing. And that, I think, really – so let's segue a little bit to talk about Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So Donald Trump – first of all, is very charismatic. I mean, that's been the secret to his TV success. He has a lot of charisma, and his followers want to enlist in his cause. He is glamorous to some people. He is less mysterious than would be optimal for glamour. But I've talked to and interviewed people who are supporters of Trump, and particularly one very articulate entrepreneur who's a small businessman who supports Trump and who had read my book, so sort of knew where I was coming from. I mean, he said, yes, there is this mystery. How does he do it? And Trump is the bright lights and the success and all the things I wish I could be, but I'm not. So there are people who find him glamorous. But much more important, I think, is that – this is a guy who made his fortune one way or another, whether it was actually building properties or in recent decades licensing his brand, in the travel and real estate businesses. And travel and real estate are industries that where glamour is tremendously important in marketing. You know, you show the ideal apartment, people picture their ideal life they picture, they go to this Trump hotel, and I actually, in the Washington Post piece I did recently, I had some quotes from the website, and, you know, it promises a lifestyle without compromise, and, you know, it's glamorous. And this is an industry where you sell things with glamour, with this promise of escape and transformation. You hide all the grubby details, and it's a little mysterious. It's distant from your regular life. So that's where he comes from. So we have Trump hotels, we have Trump resorts, we have Trump buildings, and now we have Trump America. He's going to, you know, and I think that that is where the most powerful part of glamour in his campaign.
So when you see an interview of Donald Trump in his home, in his apartment in New York, you see all this, all these columns, and it looks very Rococo, very French.
Yes.
It's gold-gilded
right.
Furniture and gold leaf everywhere and marble everywhere. And then you look at Mar-a-Lago, that enormous estate that he mm-hmm. has in Florida. It's decked out similarly. So when people see that and they see the trappings of his wealth, the way he's decided
right.
to deck
right.
out his life, is that what they see? Is that the Trump America that they see? Is that what they want?
No, I think it's – so that those are sort of the trappings of success, and they are sort of a working class person's picture of how a rich person lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost harking back to, you know,
kings.
Old movies or kings.
Yeah.
Yes, and kings, this sort of idea of magnificence, actually more than old movies. But I think when you talk about – his glamorous picture of sort of Trump America, it's not really about that. It is a sort of it's an edited version of a kind of 1950s America astride the world, the only industrial superpower.
All of which was true.
All that kind
of thing. In the
1950s. Although – what he leaves out is that we were, in fact, much, much poorer then. You know, we felt good because we were moving in the right direction and we're on top and all, you know, worldwide. But we were, as a country, much poorer than we are today. But there is this idea. So I read a lot of transcripts of Trump's speeches.
Mm-hmm.
And so I usually talk about glamour as a visual phenomenon. You see pictures. But he actually paints pictures by using certain words. And he uses certain words over and over again. And people make fun of him because he says, I have the best words, which does sound ridiculous. But he uses words like great, obviously, strong.
Huge,
yes. Build. He uses the word build a lot.
I'm a builder. That's what I do.
I'm a builder. Mm-hmm. That's what I do. You know, so he uses these words that sort of evoke a nation on the move. We're going to get things moving again.
You,
it sounds a lot like Kennedy.
Well, as you talk about it, what I'm seeing are pictures that you would see at Radio City Music Hall in the lobby of these 1930s. What's it called?
WPA.
WPA. They hired artists to show America strong and building itself
right.
into the future and out of this Great Depression. It's the same kind of thing.
Right. It is the same kind of thing, and it's very. First of all, it's very detached from the way the great achievements mm-hmm. of American business in the present moment. I mean, he says, you know, we don't win anymore. Has the man never heard of Google? I mean, which, by the way, the European Union is busy attacking. So if you want to stand up for American companies, you might want to talk about them. But he does, you know, he has never heard of them. He doesn't. So he went to Pittsburgh, and this is this kind of leaving out the details. He went to Pittsburgh, and he said, "We're going to bring steel back to Pittsburgh."
Mm-hmm.
And the people in Pittsburgh who have done a really good job of sort of reinventing their city for the new economy kind of went, say, what? But what he doesn't tell you is how did that change? So the idea is we don't have steel in Pittsburgh, big steel, because evil foreigners, you know, sold us steel too cheaply. Well, it's a little more complicated. First of all, there were these things called mini mills. New Core Corporation, maybe you've heard of it, based in Charlotte, that reinvented how you make steel.
Right.
And put a lot of competitive pressure on those big steel mills in places like Pittsburgh. Manufacturers who use steel, including the automobile industry, use a lot less steel than they used to. Now they're even switching to aluminum and looking at composites. Would it be good if suddenly the steel that the automobile industry uses got a whole lot more expensive? You know, he doesn't think about the fact that there, in the economy, we work as consumers as well as producers and even businesses buy things.
Well, as you said earlier, part of the idea of glamour, and I don't know if he consciously thinks of himself as being glamorous, probably not. Part of it is to hide.
Yeah.
You point out pictures that if you open a furniture magazine,
yes,
you will never see – you'll see a lamp on a table. You will never see the cord that connects that lamp
That's
to the
right.
power circuit. You will never see a stack of bills on that table as you would in
right,
my house.
You
will never see magazines scattered all over the furniture. It's just the furniture, and it's perfect. It's pristine. Do you think that he's just saying what people want to hear because he knows how to transmit that message because he's been in the travel and tourism industry, or whether he really believes that he can fix these problems because he's Donald Trump?
Right. Well, I think yes and yes. I think he says these things because it's persuasive, and he is a master persuader. But I also think that he has great confidence in his ability, a confidence that sort of outstrips his knowledge of the world.
And we want that in the president, don't we? We want somebody who's confident.
Yes, and this is a problem going back to this idea that we invest the president with this kind of omniscience and all these powers. If you think about something like the economy is incredibly complicated. And everybody knows a lot about their little piece of it. And so, you know, I'm willing to say Donald Trump knows a lot about the real estate business in New York. He knows very little about supply chain management or, you know, what would happen if suddenly you start to – what would happen to American businesses and American jobs if you suddenly put 35% taxes on imported air conditioners, which is something that he's talked about. You know, what would happen? It's not just – he only seen one little piece of it. He's showing the beautiful picture of, you know, all the guys making air conditioners would be happy. But what about the people who are building new buildings that need air conditioning or that are, you know, having computer installations that need to be kept cool or, you know,
or if your air conditioner at your house –
yeah, your air conditioner
goes
at
out
your
and
house.
Suddenly the price is tripled.
Right, and suddenly the price has gone up.
So don't we know this? Don't voters understand that things are cheaper today, that you can go to Walmart and buy a stack of towels for $5 that used to cost my mother more than a week's groceries, and so she wouldn't buy them?
Because
That's all connected. We don't know that in 10 seconds or less? I'll let you answer
that.
I'll let you answer it after the break because we have to come to it right now. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the North Carolina Zoo. Attendees will experience the wild side at the Run Wild 5K on June 4th at the North Carolina Zoo in Asheboro. Information at nczoo.org. Coal mining companies in Appalachia have been steadily laying off workers and closing down. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders promised to bring new economic opportunities to the area. Donald Trump says he can revive the industry. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, you can join them to discuss competing visions for America's coal workers and the future of the region. Meanwhile, we are putting together another voter roundtable for Charlotte Talks, and we want you to get involved, get in touch with our producers, and tell them a little bit about yourself. Maybe you'll find yourself around this table on this program. You can find out more about all this at WFAE.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org, WFAE on Facebook, or Twitter at Charlotte Talks will get you to us, and we are coming right back.
Doug Singleton, Executive Director, Charlotte Ballet, a WFAE underwriter. WFAE's listeners and the Charlotte Ballet's audiences are almost one and the same. We all strive for the highest quality of experience. And at WFAE and at the Charlotte Ballet Performances, you'll find that.
To learn more, email underwriting at WFAE.org for information.
Hey, Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE, excuse me. I'm Mike Collins. Virginia Pastrell is with us. She's the author of The Power of Glamour. We're talking about glamour and its intersection with the presidency, or running for the presidency. We talked a second ago about, I wrote a little note that I can no longer read here. You said that we forget about how sometimes... How things are interconnected. So Donald Trump or any presidential candidate will promise one thing, and we like that idea, but we don't understand what the fallout of that may be down the way. But that's part of glamour anyway, that glamour is used in advertising, and they never, as you say, they never tell you the downside.
Right.
But don't we know that intrinsically? Don't we know that everything is like
that? And then they're required to.
They're required to tell you that. But we obviously we ignore that and take the drugs anyway. But don't we intrinsically know that the picture being painted by anyone for anything at any time leaves out the bad stuff?
Right. So there are two things going on. One is the suspension of disbelief. We know that the bad stuff is being left out. I think when you're talking about something like the way Donald Trump talks about the economy, there's another aspect of it too. And it goes to this idea very common in political discussions of unintended consequences. So it is the bad stuff, but it's also the other side of the coin. It's not necessarily that we're thinking of it as bad. We're losing that sense of connection that you see. So we think about production, but we don't think about consumption. We think about, you know, ourselves as having jobs, but we don't think about, buying things. Or we think about the environment, but we don't think about the costs of, you know, getting the last little dab of something bad out. There, all these things are connected. And when you're in political life or political discussions, you tend to focus on one aspect of things.
Donald Trump will tell you he's incredibly rich.
Yes.
He doesn't hide it. He's not embarrassed by it. He flaunts it. And that's part of his appeal, I think, the fact that people see him and think, well, he did it. Maybe if we let America be his America, I can do it too. Bill Gates is rich. Mark Zuckerberg is rich. William Buffett is rich. But we don't aspire to be like them. The Trump fanatics aspire to be like Trump. And you describe that as a kind of blue-collar image of what it looks like to be rich. And this plays into something that I've thought a lot about. Years ago, we aspired to be wealthy and successful and classy. Like, as you mentioned, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, they reeked class, even on film.
Yeah,
maybe
right.
In their personal lives, they weren't like that. I don't know. But we saw them in beautiful gowns and tuxedos and these beautiful settings, dancing fabulously, you know. And that's what we wanted to be our lives to be like. And now we get all tatted up and we wear torn jeans, and that's not what we aspire to at all. So is that part of what Donald Trump's appeal is? He's kind of a rough and tumble rich guy.
Well, first of all, there is this, you know, he has the image that he's a rich guy, but we haven't seen his taxes. And, you know, and over the years, there have been many, many articles and biographies written long before he was in politics suggesting that he exaggerates his wealth substantially. And he actually sued one of my colleagues, a Bloomberg View colleague. It wasn't at Bloomberg View, it was long ago, over a biography that he had written where he suggested that Donald didn't have as much money as he did. And by the way, Trump lost. It was
He owns a lot of buildings. He must have some money.
Right. So that's one aspect. But different people have different ideas of what they would like to do if they got rich. And Donald Trump is kind of the classic version. You're going to have a lot of beautiful women and houses, and you decorate them all up. And reminds me in some degree of the sort of 90s hip hop style. That's if you watch the show Empire on TV, they have this hip hop mogul who sort of like the Donald Trump aesthetic of his house. That's one thing. But there are other glamorous ideas of wealth. And so you think about Bill Gates. What does Bill Gates do today with his wealth? He's a big philanthropist. And I think for a lot of younger people, actually philanthropy has become a sort of glamorous thing to do with your wealth. You think about the Silicon Valley sort of dressed down style, Mark Zuckerberg and his gray hoodies. What is that about? That's about, I don't know that I would say it's glamorous, but it's sort of like the idea that you're so smart and so rich, you can just be comfortable. And then another person that I think is a great example of sort of an aspirational type of wealth is Mark Cuban. You know, what would you do if you if you had all this money? Buy a basketball team and get into the movies and say whatever's on your mind. So different people have different ideas of wealth, but definitely when I go around and I give talks about the power of glamour, not in the political context, but just in the broader sense, I almost inevitably get a question from somebody in the audience, usually a woman, but not always, of essentially boils down to, I would really like to dress better. I would like it to be standard to get dressed up. Mm-hmm. How do we break this tyranny of informality? Right. And because we've gotten an equilibrium where you dress less and less formally.
Yes, we do. Because when I started in this business, people wore coats and ties to be on the radio.
Right.
And no one saw us, but we were in coats and ties. Does the definition – you've said that the definition of glamour changes from person to person. Right, and maybe it's changed over time, or maybe it just intersects with different people. Because Jackie and John Kennedy were certainly glamorous.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan was a movie star. Mm-hmm. He was glamorous. You mentioned Obama being glamorous in his run-up to his first term in office. And now Donald Trump is considered glamorous. All four very different individuals. Do they appeal to four very, obviously Democrat, Republican, but do they appeal to very different constituencies for different reasons?
Yes, the different constituencies for different reasons. And what is glamorous? So what is glamorous, like what is humorous, changes with the audience, personality, aspiration, changes with the times. What is it that we don't have that we wish we had? That's different in different times. There are certain things that are sort of more universal. People would like to they like wealth, or they like the things that wealth brings. They like leisure. They like, to have sex appeal. They like all these sorts of things. But then there are other things, like, for example, I talked about philanthropy. In some areas it's important, in others it's not. In sort of toward the end of The Power of Glamour, I talk about some recent examples in popular culture or advertising that exemplify different kinds of glamour. So, for example, a few years ago, Louis Vuitton ran this picture of Angelina Jolie essentially sitting in a beat-up rowboat in a swamp. And I say, if you showed this to somebody in the 1950s, they would say, well, she's pretty maybe, but this is not glamorous. This is a swamp. And, why is she wearing her gardening clothes? And, this reminds me of the Pacific Theater in World War II. I don't want to be there. But to a modern, wealthy audience that Louis Vuitton is going for, it represents tranquility, escape from the hectic, technology, represents nature. It's very green. If you know about Angelina Jolie, and it represents her philanthropic work, and she went to Cambodia and she adopted her son there. So it has this whole different resonance to that audience today, which is not the Donald Trump audience. That's a different sort of audience, but it is a contemporary audience.
Let me share some things that have come in while we've been talking. Karen on Facebook, glamour, Trump, I think, tacky. Not the least impressed with that new rich over the top crass ...
Right.
Gerald emails, perhaps a new definition of glamour is emerging here. The same following and fervor for Donald Trump seems to be similar to the following and fervor for the bearded fellows on Duck Dynasty. I'm not sure that Duck Dynasty and glamour have appeared in the same sentence until just now.
Yeah.
Pretty clever. In your TED Talks, you talk about sprezzatura.
Sprezzatura, yes.
It's an Italian word that for what? Art that conceals
art. Art that conceals art. So it's the art of making the difficult thing that everyone knows is difficult, but making it seem easy. So Fred Astaire dancing.
Right.
And again, I mean, I agree with the person who wrote about Donald Trump seems tacky in this nouveau riche. It does seem to be trying too hard, and that suggests lacking sprezzatura and lacking grace. However, you know, when I've talked to people who support him, and particularly business people who sort of see in him what they wish they were, they talk about how he makes deal making look easy. He makes, you know, he makes this sort of negotiation look easy. He makes building his company look easy. How do you do that? They know it's hard because they've tried to build companies themselves. And so they find that impressive. And if you look at who his donors are, and he doesn't have a lot, but he does have some, a lot of them are small business.
But the average small business person got into their small business because they washed out during the recession in their corporate job or because they have aspirations to be an entrepreneur or have a love or a passion for whatever they're in, and they open their business. They did not have the head start that Donald Trump had with his father, who was already a real estate mogul in the richest city in America, New York City.
Yes, and very well and a real estate mogul who was extremely well-connected politically and whose real estate empire was built very much on government subsidies.
And yet, oh, God. And yet we forget that. Why are we willing to forget that?
Well, because our memories start in the 1980s.
Okay. You mentioned that President Obama was glamorous during his run-up to the presidency. And once he got elected, some of that wore off because people became a little frustrated with him. And you say, in fact, that glamour is guaranteed to disillusion. Wow. So that will happen in spades with the Trump presidency? Because he's making a lot of big promises here.
Well, okay. So glamour is guaranteed to disillusion when it meets reality.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could keep a glamorous vision of what it would be like to, you know, be a poet and never be a poet, you know, and you could keep your glamorous vision because you never had to do it, you know. But when glamour meets reality, the mystery dissipates and the flaws show up. Now, you know, Barack Obama got elected a second term. He maintained support, but there was a lot of disillusionment. And I think with Trump, if he were to get elected, I mean, I personally think that there are lots of dangers, but in a best case scenario where he doesn't do anything crazy and doesn't accidentally start a war or, you know, decide he wants to be Mussolini or any of these, you know, really negative things, I think his supporters would be disappointed because he has promised things that no president can deliver.
Mm. Interesting that you mentioned Mussolini.
Yes.
I've heard other people say that he, if you look at him carefully, and I don't know whether this is people reading stuff into it that doesn't exist, but if you look at him carefully, the way he carries himself, the way he presents himself on stage during a speech, and then you go back and you look at old film of Benito Mussolini in Italy, it's the same outward appearance.
Right.
And in your book, you talk about that there's a hidden aspect to glamour. It can be dangerous, and you point to National Socialism, Nazis.
Yeah.
They were glamorous, you say.
Yeah.
How
well,
so?
Actually, so this was in the TED Talk. I actually changed my mind when I was doing the book, but we could talk. I decided that the Nazis were not really so much glamorous as they were using a kind of spectacle. They're overwhelming people. It wasn't about longing and projecting yourself. It was sort of about intimidation or being lost in the crowd. But Mussolini did use glamour. And there is a distinction. And today we read Italian fascism through the experience of World War II and through the Nazis. But they were different, and it was around for a much longer period, and it was a much more sort of aspirational, much more it's easy when you read about the rise of Mussolini, it's sort of easy to put yourself in the mind of Italians of that period who they wanted to feel proud of their country. They wanted to feel like it was modern and on the move, that it wasn't just about things that happened 500 years ago, but that it was great today. And one thing that is – now, I am not saying – let me – I am not – fascist means something. Yes. It's not just a dirty word. So I am not saying that Trump is a fascist. But there are parallels to Mussolini, to the appeal, to the longings that motivated Mussolini's followers. And also, Mussolini had this phrase, vincere e vinceremo, which means win and we will win. That does sound familiar as well. So that desire to win. I mean, these are – glamour appeals to deep human emotions, and the desire to feel like a winner, the desire to feel like your country is winning, is one such thing.
When you have a glamorous candidate, which Donald Trump is, and you have somebody who's not glamorous, which Hillary Clinton you say is not, does glamour carry a lot of weight? And what would you, because you spoke to the John Locke Foundation, I can't imagine that they're Donald Trump supporters. So what would you tell them, or Hillary Clinton, about how to defeat Donald Trump?
So it's a very,
very
tricky
quickly.
Thing. Yes.
10 seconds.
So try to reveal what's being hidden. So, for example, it may be a little boring, but talk about the economic ramifications of his policies.
Okay. Virginia Postrell, a Bloomberg View columnist and the author of The Power of Glamour, and you can see her TED Talk about all this as well online. Thank you for the hour.